It seemed a little sleazy to us, but what did we know? He seemed to have a grasp of the ins and outs of college financial aid and suggested that this was the way all the smart people did it. We did buy the annuities from him, one for each child. We made regular contributions to the funds through automatic payroll deductions. The financial genius's advice all turned out to be laughably off base. When the time came, the supposedly shielded assets did nothing to help us. We had saved some money for college, which is good. We had also paid a percentage of those investments to him as fees, which was also good, at least for him. Here's what went wrong. For one thing, if we'd gone for a fancy school, it would have required a financial aid form that does require the annuities to be declared. Maybe. My income was pretty good, even though living in New Jersey meant that my expenses were high enough that my take-home pay was meager. For most schools, my income disqualified us for quite a bit of financial aid, though we hoped that our expected family contribution, determined from the FAFSA, should have reduced our tuition by something like $10,000 a year. But here's the part they don't tell you until you show up for orientation. And the peppy orientation advisors take the kids into one room to talk about how fantastic the school is going to be, and the parents are taken into another room to hear a grim lecture from the financial aid office. And on a lovely day in Ann Arbor, where my daughter had been accepted at the University of Michigan, go blue, I heard the lecture for the first time, and it hit me like a gut punch. If you're coming in from out of state, you can kiss all that expected family contribution stuff goodbye. In that parent orientation seminar, what they told us is that they meet the need of in-state students with financial aid. They don't do it for out-of-state students. Oh. At the suggestion of a colleague who lived in Michigan and knew everyone at the university, I called a friend of hers who happened to run the university's financial aid office. What could we do? Were there any reductions in tuition available? She was calm and practiced in her delivery. The school costs what it costs, she said, adding, maybe you can't afford to send your daughter to the University of Michigan. She didn't mean it in a cruel way. She was simply stating a fact. But she loves Michigan, I replied. The official suggested that our children might want a large number of things, but that didn't mean we had to provide them all. I thanked her and told her we would try to find a way, but that I would appreciate anything that she could do. She said she would take a look at Elizabeth's transcript and application. A few days later, we got a note saying that Elizabeth had qualified for a scholarship that would reduce her tuition by a few thousand dollars a year. It was basically a 10% discount. We took a deep breath and enrolled Elizabeth at Michigan, the school of her dreams. We're suckers that way. We cashed in the annuities to pay for Elizabeth's first semesters at the University of Michigan. Jean hated the idea of continuing to pay money into a financial instrument just so we could receive money out of the same financial instrument, especially if it didn't provide any of the promised advantages in lowering the expected contribution from our family to the school. And despite our years of savings, the expected payments from the annuities, as it turned out, were not going to cover the cost of these college loans. So we decided to eliminate the middleman and pay the money we'd collected directly to the school. I hoped that the fees we paid him helped pay for his own son's tuition at tennis school. At least we hadn't given him our 401k to manage. The next year, when we saw the accountant who does our taxes, he pronounced himself annoyed that we had bought into those financial instruments. A plain-spoken guy, he pointed out that these annuities are something that are designed for long-term accumulation, like decades, and they were completely inappropriate for a shorter-term payout, like a college savings account. Once again, we had learned a valuable lesson of investing, which is to choose advisors wisely. Vet anyone who is trying to sell you something. Ask the right questions about their conflicts of interest. Other lessons. A fool and his money are soon parted. Don't be an idiot. Something like that. We didn't lose a lot of money on the accounts, in any case, and cashing them in didn't incur a big penalty. Cashing in those accounts, however, still would not be enough to pay for college. The cost of going to Michigan at the time was something like $38,000 a year. We needed more. Along with our misguided attempt at clever annuity management, we ended up with a nice windfall that helped put our girl through college. Oil and gas money. Some years back, Jean's dad had given her and her brother the mineral rights to property his family used to own. Mineral rights can be owned separately from the surface rights to the land itself. Every few months, a royalty check would show up in the mail for Jean's share of oil production from the land, or natural gas. Most of the time it was enough for dinner for the whole family at McDonald's. It was never enough for dinner at a steakhouse, but it was always welcome and felt very Texan. Once in a while, a land man, the people who buy up mineral rights for oil and gas companies, would send us a letter asking if Jean wanted to sell and would name a price. Generally, the money offered was in the range of a couple of $1,000. Such offers represented years' worth of the payments, but not a lifetime's worth. And we liked holding on to the rights. Because, you know, Texas. Jean's dad told us that he considered the mineral rights to be like an annuity, the kind of thing you never sell. Being crude, har-har, I liked telling her how nice it was to be sleeping with an oil heiress. She'd joke back, "I've got gas, too." One day, though, during a long run-up in the price of oil, we got a different kind of letter. These new folks offered $25,000 for Jean's oil rights. We saw the offer as the product of a speculative bubble that might not show up again for a long time. We took the deal. That money paid for a little more than one semester of her college. Jean still had her gas. Those checks have been getting smaller and smaller. The fracking boom has driven the price of oil and natural gas down. But somehow, in an age when sea levels are rising and 196 nations agreed to the Paris Climate Accord, pledging to do what they could to limit warming and stave off the most catastrophic damage of climate change, well, the romance of having gas has faded. We weren't unhappy to see it dwindle. A climate change reporter profiting off fossil fuels? Awkward. Still, we've held on to it. Because Texas. There was another windfall for us when it came to the kids. Jean's father also at one point told us that he was creating funds for the kids' college savings funds, setting aside $10,000 apiece. The idea was that they would grow in value over time. They also went, all three funds, to pay Elizabeth's tuition. We'd figure out what to do for the other kids when they hit college age, we decided. We needed to pay today's bills today. This is the way it goes for many families. Whatever you were able to save for your kids' college educations, it won't be enough. In most cases, you will cash out all the savings to pay for the first child's education, and will take care of the rest with loans. It worked out. Elizabeth got a great education at Michigan. It prepared her for the intellectual rigors of law school. Michigan also introduced her to Matt. Tell me that money wasn't well spent. The out-of-state tuition squeeze put us on the hook, for Elizabeth, at Michigan, for Sam, at Penn State, and for Joe, at Iowa. Yes, the kids all chose state schools out-of-state. A blessing, because even at inflated out-of-state rates, it was far less expensive than comparable private schools. But still. Paying for college. Let's go a little deeper into how college gets paid for. According to SLM Corporation, the company known as Sallie Mae, which provides student loans, just 40% of families have a plan in place to pay for all 4 years of college before enrollment. College aid comes in three forms: grants and scholarships, which don't need to be paid back, loans, which do, and work-study jobs. The biggest federal grant program, the Pell Grant, is generally available to children of families earning $50,000 a year or less. For the 2016-2017 school year, recipients could get a maximum of $5,815. Families with more kids might qualify for Pell Grants even though their annual income is somewhat higher than $50,000, because the financial pressure of the number of children is taken into account. Scholarships come in two basic flavors, merit-based and need-based. Merit-based scholarships require some qualification or achievement, say, great grades. Need-based scholarships are, as the name suggests, about financial need. The Sallie Mae report found that 35% of college costs are paid from scholarships and grants, 23% by parent income and savings, 8% by parent borrowing, 19% by student borrowing, and 11% by student income and savings. 4% comes from other relatives and friends. Scholarships are great, but they only defray some costs. Few students are going to get a free ride on their athletic skills or math scores. Elizabeth's grant helped us at Michigan, but some friends scoffed when I told them that it amounted to just 10% of our costs. I guess their young geniuses did better. Who knows? It was money, and we took it. Joseph, too, qualified for a tuition reduction at Iowa because of his good ACT scores. Most scholarships don't actually bring in all that much money, and so many students apply for dozens, even hundreds of them. That method is a little like extreme couponing. You can make money at it, but you have to ask whether the game is worth the candle. Many of the available scholarships are very specific in nature. What I like to think of as the left-handed, blue-eyed Norwegian problem. Is it worth scanning sites like fastweb.com and capex.com, scholarships.com, and Big Future, the scholarship site of the College Board, to see what you might qualify for? Absolutely. You never know what you'll find. But, at least for Elizabeth, it didn't seem like something worth turning into a full-time job of essay writing. In her junior and senior year, she made more money babysitting than she would have from minor scholarships. I called Mark Kantrowitz, the former publisher of FastWeb and current publisher of CapEx. He said that many parents delude themselves about paying for college. Parents have a tendency to overestimate eligibility for merit-based aid and underestimate their eligibility for need-based aid, he said. Only 1 in 8 students uses scholarships to help pay college costs, he said, and the average is about $4,000. So scholarships are part of your plan for paying for college, but they aren't your entire plan, he said. Less than 1% of students get a full ride, and very few scholarships are generous enough to cover all college costs. Even athletic scholarships aren't as juicy as they seem from the outside, he said. Less than 2% of high school athletes go on to receive college athletic scholarships, and the average amount is $10,000, he said. He said I was wrong, however, about the efficacy of having kids apply for lots of smaller scholarships. Every dollar you win is a dollar you don't have to borrow, he said. And every dollar you borrow will cost $2 by the time you pay it off. Doing a large number of scholarship applications is not much more trouble than doing a few, he said. The essay questions tend to be fairly repetitive, and the process, after a while, becomes a matter of cut and paste. The most important things, he said, are to never pay a scholarship search service, probably a scam, and to get an early start so that your child doesn't miss deadlines in applying for scholarships. By the time a student has been accepted at a school, a number of the deadlines for independent scholarships have passed. He acknowledged that students who make A's are twice as likely to get those scholarships as B students, because the skills that win those grades also work to their advantage in the application process. But he estimated that a teenager spending 10 hours applying for smaller scholarships, they have fewer applicants than the ones that provide $500 or more, can bring in $500, he said. And I don't know any high school student who can get $50 an hour doing something legal, he said. If you plan to save for your children's higher education, there are plenty of ways to do it through a variety of programs at the state and federal level. The best known are called 529 plans because they were created under Section 529 of the Internal Revenue Code, and they are administered by states or schools. This brings up a question all parents wonder about. Do savings plans affect your college aid eligibility? In other words, do we hurt ourselves by saving? The answer is yes, kind of, but not much. Yes, savings are counted against your estimated family contribution, but in a way that is weighted to minimize the damage to you for having been good. Parental assets are counted at a favorable rate to encourage savings, so only 5.64% of parental assets are counted toward the expected family contribution. So if you saved $10,000 for your student, it will increase your expected family contribution by $564. The higher your expected family contribution, the less money you'll get. But 5.64% allows you to save a lot with a fairly low penalty, and money drawn from a 529 plan does not count as income for purposes of the next year's financial aid assessment. Saving for college, as important as it is, rarely works out as well as we'd hope. According to Fidelity Investments College Savings Indicator Study, the average family will get less than a third of the way to meeting its college savings goals before their child graduates from high school. The fact is, unless you have planned things exquisitely well, have a winner of the Regeneron Science Talent Search on your hands, $250,000 scholarship for first place, or have deep financial resources of your own, you are almost certainly going to be paying for college with loans. Those can come from private lenders or from government programs provided by Uncle Sam and many states. Some friends told us that they had put all the college loans in their kids' names, putting the burden of repayment on them. Other friends told me that they split the debt with their kids. Considering the cost of a college education, either option helps the parents save for retirement, but puts the next generation in a deep, deep hole. Jean and I discussed this and realized that we did not want our kids to start off in life with crushing undergraduate debt. We couldn't afford to pay for college for the kids outright, but we told them that we would take out the lion's share of the loans, applying to the federal government under the federal loan program known as PLUS. Our kids also qualified for smaller amounts of money under the federal Stafford Loan Program, which goes directly to them. Elizabeth took on the loans for law school, again at a public university, UT Austin, in her own name. Note well, dear listener, we paid for their college educations with loans from the government, not from private lenders. This is another of the rare things we did right. Private lenders will bombard you and your kids with education loan offers, but the risks are high. The private lenders can jack up the interest rates on the loans. Federal direct loans, by comparison, come with a fixed rate. You don't want that kind of burden, especially since student loan debt is forever. Congress passed a law in 2005 saying that you could not even discharge your student debt in bankruptcy. So it's important to avoid a debt treadmill that is even worse than the one that federal loans put you on. If you haven't saved at all and college is staring you in the face, there are still options. In addition to loans and those scholarships, there are also ways to stretch those dollars, notes Ron Lieber. A gap year can help you and your student build up cash that can help reduce the amount you have to borrow. Another option is military service, which can lead to education benefits that will help pay for college. Lower-cost options like community college can give your student a start in higher education that can lead to a transfer to a terrific 4-year school. This is just an introduction to the enormously complicated world of college financial aid. If you've listened to this much, you're ready to dig deeper. For more information, check out the Federal Department of Education Financial Aid Information site, studentaid.ed.gov/essay, and savingforcollege.com, which specializes in 529 plans. Okay, that's money, but what about values? How can we make sure that our kids have the right values, especially when it comes to money? The best way is setting an example and discussing money with the kids openly. Everything from the tooth fairy to college tuition. That is the lesson of my New York Times colleague Ron Lieber's book, The Opposite of Spoiled: Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. I can't say we're the best example of financial stability, but we had good lessons before us when it comes to energy and drive, at least. My father, A.R. Schwartz, was a scrapper and a striver. He was born dirt poor. When he'd get mad at us for complaining about money, he'd say, "We didn't have a pot to piss in and throw away," which quieted us down, at least partly because I'd have to stop to think through why anyone would piss in a pot. Life in the Depression was, I decided, confusing. In fact, Dad's father and mother divorced when he was a little boy, and his mother had next to nothing to live on. She would send my father into the bars where my grandfather was entertaining women. Dad would have to walk up to him and say, "Hi, Pop," and ask for the child support he owed them. Before long, Dad got good at making his own money, renting beach chairs and umbrellas on Galveston's beaches from the age of 11, and later working as a lifeguard. "I was earning more tips than I was getting in child support," he told me. In college, Dad worked at the dining halls and would buy plastic rain ponchos for pennies and sell them in the stadium at football games for 50 cents, or a dollar when it started to rain. In the Navy, during aircraft ordnance training in Norman, Oklahoma, he and some buddies would hitchhike south to Dallas during breaks and bring back $3 bottles of whiskey, which they would raffle off for 50 cents a ticket. "I had entrepreneurship," he told me. He became a lawyer and legislator and provided well for us. He always worked, though over time it was clear that he wasn't working to get rich. He put more faith in his legislative pension than in investments, and while he played with some individual stocks, as a child of the Depression, he put most of his savings into certificates of deposit that were rock solid in terms of safety, but paid little interest. To Dad, work was about buying the life you want, but not building a mountain of cash. By the way, when Dad turned 90, Galveston dedicated a stretch of beach for him. Babe's Beach. It was a great tribute, and it will probably attract plenty of Houston bros hoping to see Babe's. Gene's father, John Mixon, had also come up through poverty. His own father had died when he was just a boy, and he and his mother kept a small farm going. He came through the experience with the same entrepreneurial spirit as my dad had, driven by poverty to work both as a law professor and as an independent researcher in urban issues, investing cannily. Jean said that when she was growing up, he refused to have chicken on his table. He'd had to eat too many of his family's chickens as a boy, and it tasted of poverty. Our mothers, too, worked. My mom had an insurance company, and Jean's mom was a nurse. From childhood on, we saw and we learned. In elementary school, I teamed up with a friend, Brad Schreiber, to form a company. We drew up cards that read, "S&S Enterprises. We'll do anything for money." We planned to do odd jobs, but were held back by a lack of odd jobs that needed doing, and our own lack of general competence. In high school and college, I had a string of part-time jobs. I finally found something I wanted to do: journalism. I'd like to think that I work at it as hard as my dad works at the things he loves, but it's not a trade that can make me rich. Like Dad, I haven't focused on trying to amass wealth. I love that line from Citizen Kane. It's no trick to make a lot of money if all you want is to make a lot of money. Jean grew up wanting financial independence and worked her way through college and graduate school. Burger joint, legislative clerk, transcriptionist. She's a hellaciously fast typist. And other jobs. Have we instilled good money sense in our own next generation? As I've mentioned, Elizabeth is a lawyer, like her husband, and is aggressively paying down her law school debt. Sam, who has worked aboard cruise ships and is preparing to teach English overseas, makes me as proud as Elizabeth does. The money he saves goes to further travels. He is happy. I think he will find a way to a good living. He's in his 20s, and there's time to explore. Joseph is working full-time, having taken a break from college after 2 years. He is money-conscious and careful about spending, but he has also had to deal with clinical depression, and helping him get to a life of satisfaction and happiness means far more to me right now than whether he has chosen the right balance of risk and reward in his 401k. All three of our kids are good people. They are well-read and generous, and each is touched with a generous measure of sweetness, even acerbic, snarky Joe, that thrills me. I admire friends whose kids are super achievers, getting into Ivy League schools, and go on to beat the world. These things are easy to brag on, and I don't blame the parents for doing so. We focused on something more fundamental. Happiness. And I have to say, the return on that investment has been splendid. Punch list. Saving for college. If it's too late for you, show this to your kids. As with all things financial, the earlier you start saving for college, the better. But how much should you save? And how should you do it? There are just three rules when it comes to saving for college. 1. Start as early as possible. Vanguard calculates that if you open an account right after your child is born and contribute $3,000 a year, and if your investments earn 5% a year, you'll end up with nearly $90,000 by age 18. Start at 9, and you'll earn $54,000 less, which is still $35,000, which is great. But it could be so much more. As with so many things, there is a rule of thumb for college savings. And as with so many rules of thumb, it's partly right and partly wrong. The 2K rule of thumb for figuring out how much you should have saved already, devised by Fidelity, is disarmingly simple. If your goal is to save enough to pay half of college costs, assuming the rest will come from sources like scholarships and loans, the rule calls for you to multiply your child's age by $2,000. For a 7-year-old, that means you'd better have saved $14,000. This is, of course, not very helpful when you consider the enormous range of costs in higher education. The economical state college versus stratospheric tabs at private schools like Middlebury or Tulane or the University of Southern California. But, as the folks at Fidelity will tell you, it's a source of incentive to start saving and keep saving. The company offers a college savings calculator on its website as well. The questions are likely to induce hyperventilation. Today, what is the approximate 1-year cost of the school your child may attend? And what percent of the cost do you expect to cover from savings? Try it as an exercise. Get used to the idea that these are questions you will have to answer. You can find other college savings calculators at Vanguard, Charles Schwab, and any other investment firm. 2. Come up with your own savings plan and start contributing to it. A 2016 Sallie Mae report says that 61% of parents use only savings accounts, and 38% use only checking accounts to save for college. Don't do that. Use a special college investment account that can help you save and invest at the same time, with tax advantages along the way. The most common savings accounts are the 529 plans mentioned in this chapter. State-sponsored and tax-advantaged, the money is generally invested in mutual funds. You can also save for college using so-called custodial accounts, created under the Uniform Gifts to Minors Act, UGMA, or Uniform Transfers to Minors Act, UTMA. Once the child comes of age, whatever has been saved goes to that student and the money can be used for any purpose. Some parents are uncomfortable with that idea, though I'm sure you trust your own children completely. Both the UGMA and UTMA plans are available through investment companies like Vanguard, Fidelity, Schwab, and the rest. You can save for college with the same people who are helping you save for retirement. 3. Stick with it. Be strong. As with other investments, if you possibly can, set it and forget it. Chapter 8. Medical Disasters. Unless you are truly wealthy, your financial world could be upended with startling suddenness by illness. In 2001, then Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Warren and her research colleagues found that illness and medical bills were partly to blame for about half of personal bankruptcies in the United States. By 2007, an updated report found that the percentage of illness and injury-related bankruptcy had grown to 62%. The actual percentage is still a matter of some dispute. A later paper by a lawyer and bankruptcy researcher, Daniel Austin, arguing that bankruptcies are rarely caused by a single factor, said that medical costs were the predominant causal factor in 18 to 26% of cases. Still, he acknowledged that medical costs are nonetheless the single largest causal factor in consumer bankruptcy. Warren, of course, is now a United States senator from Massachusetts and often makes the point that, as she said in a January 2017 tweet, most people in this country are one health crisis away from financial ruin. There's little doubt that the Affordable Care Act has alleviated some of this financial pressure. A research paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research suggested that Obamacare reduced medical debt among low-income people by $600 to $1,000 a year. One of the researchers, Robert Kiesner, a professor of health economics at the University of Illinois, told Margot Sanger Katz of the New York Times that medical financial distress has ripple effects. If people are skipping bills and going into debt, then it can have other repercussions. As Elizabeth Warren showed, it doesn't take much to go from financial debt to bankruptcy. But Obamacare showed that it's possible to improve things. In 2010, when Barack Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law, personal bankruptcies in the United States stood at 1,536,799. 6 years later, the number had dropped by half, to 770,846. Of course, some of these can be attributed to the end of the Great Recession and to a tightening of bankruptcy rules. But the role of Obamacare in reducing the number of financial shipwrecks can't be ignored. There were problems with the law, of course, especially in states that didn't implement the Medicaid expansion part of it. Though the program is not in what Donald Trump and many Republican members of Congress call a death spiral at this writing, some marketplaces are down to a single insurer, and the premiums in many states have jumped. That has meant that many people whose income is too high for government insurance subsidies have been squeezed, and hard. Like the majority of Americans, I'd rather see the problems with the program fixed than see it repealed. Because we've had our own scrapes with medical disaster, and insurance was the difference between keeping on and going down in flames. The call you never want to get. Our closest call came in the spring of 2015. Things seemed to be going great for us. Selling our house the previous year had gotten us out from under the college loans and paid off our credit cards. We had more money at the end of the month than ever before. I still couldn't buy dinner at expensive restaurants, but I could indulge in a couple of thick steaks for the grill without fretting too much about it. I could even buy the good stuff over at Whole Foods. The cloud of financial worry had become less threatening than at any time I can remember since our college days. That is, of course, when life reminds you that there's still plenty of chaos and pain out there, waiting for you to drop your guard. I was driving around the campus neighborhood of Iowa City with our youngest, Joseph. He was 19 and had just finished his first year of college. I had moved him out of his University of Iowa dorm room and had driven over to the apartment he had rented for the coming school year. We were going to check it out before making the drive back home. Jean stayed home for this one. No sense in both of us making that 1,000-mile drive if we could help it. And besides, she didn't want to take time off from her job as a crossing guard. When Jean doesn't work, she doesn't get paid, and that paycheck is an important part of keeping us afloat. As I was parking the car, a message popped up on my phone. "Your wife is okay, but had an accident. Please call me. 862-216, blah, blah, blah." I didn't recognize the handle, but of course I called. A woman whose voice was unfamiliar to me told me that Jean had been hit by a car. The person at the other end of the phone was Gabby Stern. Joseph had gone to high school with her daughter, who was walking with her father by Jean's corner. They saw Jean lying on the ground, bleeding from a gash at the back of her head. Cops were all around, and an ambulance was pulling up. The daughter recognized Jean and called her mother, who was, at that time, an employee of the Wall Street Journal. Gabby didn't know how to reach me at first, then remembered laughing at my tweets. She sent me the note through the direct message function on Twitter. So now you know that Twitter is good for something. I called Gabby and gave her my phone number. She had her husband, Jeff, call me. He was still on the scene and let me know briefly what was going on before handing the phone to a police officer. The officer explained that an elderly woman in a Volvo had smacked into Jean while she was helping kids cross the street during the after-school rush. The impact had knocked Jean down, and she hit her head hard enough to be knocked cold. They were sending her to a hospital in Morristown, a surprise to me, since there are closer medical centers. "Why there?" I asked. "It's the regional trauma center for head wounds," he said. "Wait, what? How serious was this?" I asked. The officer couldn't say, but he did tell me that she was no longer unconscious. "She's been talking," he said, "but there's a lot of blood." Horrifying. I was, at that moment, 1,000 miles away. The drive home would take at least 15 hours. No one could tell me how badly she was hurt. Joseph and I had planned to take 2 days to drive home, with a night in a hotel to rest. I was frantic, jumpy, frazzled. "Joe," I asked, "do you mind if we try to drive straight through?" We stopped by the local Starbucks for a quad espresso and started the drive. Along the way, I reached friends who agreed to go to the hospital to be with her. When the hospital discharged her later that night, they helped her get home. Whether she should have been discharged with a serious concussion is another matter, but we don't need to get into that. Later that evening, she got on the phone with me to tell me to find a hotel and not to push myself too hard. As if. Joseph and I pulled up to the house around 7 a.m. He went up to his room to sleep, and I climbed into bed next to Jean. She was wearing what looked like a bloody turban that cushioned her head and left an open space to expose the stitches. She was groggy and miserable. It would be days before she could focus her eyes enough to read again, and more than a week before she could follow the plot of a novel. But we were together, and we felt lucky. She was injured on the job. Workers' compensation would pay all her medical costs. It's a cumbersome process, but we did not have to deal with tens of thousands of dollars in bills. Even if it had not been a work-related injury, my health insurance with the Times would have covered much of the cost. And thanks to Obamacare, even if I did not have a job that provided me with insurance, I'd have been able to buy it. We would not be the medical bankrupts that Elizabeth Warren has written about. But every time we saw a bill and saw the mounting costs that somebody else was paying, we had to wonder how other people dealt with this. Without adequate insurance, all our financial gains of the previous year would have been wiped out. We'd have been back in the hole. I'd have been back on fries and gravy. Jean returned to work, though the police moved her to a less busy corner. It earned her less money per month. The risks tied to the old corner had come with rewards. But her safety was our first consideration. Because of a quirk of New Jersey law, we were not eligible to sue the driver who hit her. The Garden State's auto liability laws are no fault, which basically means that policyholders recover their financial losses from their own insurance company. It simplifies insurance, but the dozen states that have no-fault insurance limit the ability of people to file lawsuits in auto accident cases. Under New Jersey law, Jean would have had to have suffered a permanent or disfiguring injury in order to qualify to sue the driver over the accident. Apparently, we could have retained the right to sue for less grievous injury by checking a box on our auto insurance company's policy form and paying dearly for the right every year. But we never even noticed it. At the urging of friends, I spoke with two lawyers about whether there was a way to sue anyway. One was aggressive and explained that we could probably establish that there had been a permanent injury if we set up an MRI to look for herniated discs or other soft tissue damage. If they do an MRI and find there are disc herniations, that gets you over the threshold, he explained. Other forms of injury might be established. He said he had a friendly neurologist up in Hackensack who worked on a contingency fee basis and would get part of our settlement or jury award. There would be no hourly fees along the way. What I say is, get what you can get, he explained. A second lawyer, a second opinion. This guy was less interested in the battery of tests than how Jean was doing and how she was feeling. The restriction on lawsuits, known as the verbal threshold, is hard to overcome, he said. A scar to the back of the head is not going to be a disfiguring scar, he told me. He also wasn't big on paying for a lot of tests, or the idea of claiming some permanent damage. In any case, he said, this is all way too premature to be talking about. Once her medical treatment was complete, we could see whether there was evidence of permanent injury or persistent pain. You won't know until the treating doctor says we can do no more, he said. Hopefully the stitches will heal, and she won't have recurrent headache, post-concussion syndrome, whatever, or other aches, pains, and injuries that she might have. He then asked me the only really important question. Does it look like she's going to make a full recovery? It did. That, he said, was the outcome we really wanted. Have a good life, he said. Even over the phone I could tell that he was smiling. I don't know for sure, but I'll bet the second lawyer had read Dickens' Bleak House, the story of families destroyed by being sucked into the courts in never-ending litigation. Bleak House was the first Dickens novel I read, just before starting law school. Its law-related tragedies, the infinite cross-generational tangles of the famous case, Jarndyce and Jarndyce, through the British Chancery system, was one of the things that helped convince me that writing would be a better path for me than litigating. I was haunted by the words spoken by Mr. Gridley, a man destroyed by the legal system, and who says of his friend Miss Flight, "There is a tie of many suffering years between us two, and it is the only tie I ever had on earth that Chancery has not broken." Which lawyer's advice do you think we took? By now, you probably know us well enough to have figured out that we went with the option of not pushing things. Jean had been through an awful time, a lot of pain, a lot of trauma. She didn't want to relive it with more medical tests and a court fight over some ill-defined injury, and the first lawyer's tactics made us uncomfortable. So we didn't go forward with a lawsuit. Jean, meanwhile, kept getting calls from the driver's insurance company, asking her to sit down with them for an interview. They never explained what they wanted to know, though it appeared that they were bracing for litigation. They didn't know whether we could sue, They hadn't asked about the verbal threshold. Jean told them that her medical bills were being paid by workers' comp, and she did not want any representative of the company coming into our home or meeting her in a coffee shop. Finally, she agreed to go to their offices, but soon became agitated by the agent's repeated questions about the accident, where Jean had been standing, whether she had run out into the crosswalk as the driver had insisted. The driver's lies were pathetic. "It's all in the police report," she said, her voice rising. The representative, flustered, asked her to calm down and reminded her that he had not caused the accident. "I didn't either," Jean shouted, shaking with anger. "Your client hit me." The interview ended. Jean went home. The call stopped. Well, almost. Sometime later, Jean called me at work to say the insurance company had called her one more time and had offered a settlement of $10,000. Jean accepted it on the spot. I might have tried to negotiate, but Jean wanted it all to be over, over, over. And we knew that people with serious, lasting injuries had received settlements that did not amount to much more than that, especially after the lawyer's cut. So we were done, and we moved on. Over the next year and a half, Jean would have other medical emergencies, including gallbladder attacks that required two surgical procedures in 3 days, ending with the doctors taking out the offending organ. I developed an unasked-for familiarity with the offerings at the St. Barnabas Medical Center cafeteria in Livingston, New Jersey. "Try the fried chicken." She has come through each of these incidents in good health, and we were grateful not to be financially devastated by adventures that start with a late-night visit to the emergency room. It all drove home an important message. Life is chaotic. It will mess with you. Is this news? Of course not. But it all reminds me of the New Yorker cartoon by Lee Lorenz from 1989 that shows a businessman swaggering down the street, thinking to himself, "Less cholesterol, regular checkups, no nicotine, no alcohol, low sodium, moderate exercise, no sugar." He is oblivious to the steel safe plummeting toward him from above. I especially love this cartoon because of where I first encountered it. In the Bethesda, Maryland bedroom of Jules Lodish, a brilliant hematologist and oncologist who I met during my years at the Washington Post. Several years before my visit, Lodish had been struck by amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. He had been slow to notice a growing weakness in 1994, until, "One day I couldn't turn the keys in my car," he told me, "even using both hands." When I visited him in 2000, he spent his days unable to move, a machine at his side doing his breathing for him. But he was still able to talk, eloquently, endlessly, with humor and wisdom, his brain unaffected while his body went slack. He called the condition having a ringside seat at your own demise. He had insurance and pressured the company to allow him to be treated at home. He had been told he would likely survive just 2 years after his diagnosis. He believed that he could manage his own care more effectively there, which would be likely to help him survive longer. He wrote up a 35-page instruction manual for nurses that would prevent the infections that cause the death of many ALS patients. It worked. He lived for 15 years with the condition, dying in 2008. In that time, he saw two of his three children marry and counseled many patients and their families about living with crushing medical conditions. As he wrote to a friend, using a computer equipped with a sensor that registered keystrokes through twitches of his cheek, "Quintessentially, I have found that ambulation, movement, swallowing, eating, talking, breathing, and self-care are not me. They are substantial physical losses, but they are not me." I don't bring up Jules Lodish's story because it is depressing, or even because it is inspiring, which it surely is. I bring it up because his illness came out of the blue, like that hurtling safe. Again, I've leaped from the financial to the metaphysical. But let's circle back. Thanks in part to my experience with Lodish, I keep the health insurance paid up and have insisted that the kids have insurance as well. Without it, problems quickly become crises. And you never know when. We also built up a cushion of several thousand dollars for emergencies. I set aside the most recent nest egg from the advance payment for this book. It sits there, waiting for us to need it. But when an unexpected car problem or home repair comes up, it's a comfort not to have to borrow money for the fix. Jean just celebrated her 60th birthday. Her dad called and said, "I'm glad you're still here." Then a friend from our college days called and said exactly the same thing, which unsettled her a bit, as if there's a betting board up somewhere with her name on it. So I didn't say it to her, but I felt it. When medical crises take everything away. While our medical emergencies haven't shipwrecked us financially, we know people whose own health crises have. I spent an afternoon recently with Jolie Solomon, a good friend and a successful journalist who is now living in poverty. Illness, hers, and her daughter's, were major factors. We worked together nearly 30 years ago. We were on similar paths. We made similar salaries. And at her peak, she was out-earning me by quite a chunk. We both were building savings in a 401k with generous contributions. There are differences, too, of course. She was a single mother, and I had a supportive partner. I stayed well. Jolie got sick. It was the kind of illness that Elizabeth Warren was talking about. Jolie came up through the trade press and local newspapers and worked up to publications like the Wall Street Journal and Newsweek, where we worked together in the business section. Funny and creative, Jolie was a joy to work with and had deep expertise in the business world and personal finance. Within Newsweek, she rose to the position of Deputy Chief of Correspondence and went on to Time, Inc., where she served as the deputy managing editor at Fortune Small Business. By then she was making very good money, $125,000 a year. And she was funneling a fair amount of that income into a retirement account that, by 2006, had come up to $350,000. She figured that she had 20 years of work ahead of her and was on track to build a very comfortable retirement. Baby boomers grew up with this idea that we were going to have things better, easier than our parents, she said. And it seemed to be working out that way. Her father, a school teacher, had gone hungry as a child. Jolie, by the time she was just 2 years out of graduate school, was earning more than him. She bought a lovely house in Maplewood, New Jersey, in 1995 for $175,000. It was the town she'd grown up in, and where her parents still lived, so it felt comfortable. A year later, direct train service opened from Maplewood into Manhattan, and property values began to soar. In the mid-2000s, she applied for a $75,000 home equity line of credit. The genial banker urged her to take twice as much as she had asked for, and she found herself questioning him like a skeptical journalist about whether they were doing enough to assess whether she was a good credit risk. "You guys don't ask very many questions on this thing," she said. "Should I really be taking this much?" But the offer was hard to resist, and she figured that she would never need more than a fraction of the credit that was being made available to her. "I'm ashamed to say I took the whole $150,000 because I was amazed and felt rich to be able to do such a thing." And things would have been fine if her earnings and home value had stayed high, but they didn't. In 2001, she took a buyout at Time, Inc., which was under financial pressure to downsize thanks to its spectacularly ill-advised merger with America Online. Jolie found work at another magazine, but the money wasn't as good as it had been at Time. A buyout there led her through a succession of jobs in a changing media environment. Most of the gigs offered lower pay and stingier benefits than she'd gotten in the past. But by 2006, she had landed at More Magazine, and was earning six figures again. She tried not to show it, but Jolie was also in near constant pain because of conditions that had been worsening, including a chronic bladder inflammation that had tormented her since childhood. In her 30s, she also got a diagnosis of fibromyalgia, a painful condition that can also be accompanied by sleep problems and other health issues. During these years, her father developed Alzheimer's disease and died. Her mother, too, would develop the disease. Worse, her daughter, Lily, was in trouble. She had developed a neurological condition in elementary school that contributed to depression and anxiety. Those conditions would worsen in middle school and high school. Lily's health problems meant a punishingly expensive 7-year search for effective treatments. And the best doctors and most effective treatments often were not covered by insurance. Jolie was struggling to find medical treatments for them both, while also trying to get the schools to provide her daughter with services she was entitled to under the law. That required a lawyer, meaning thousands of dollars more to spend. And all the while, she was trying to hold down her high-powered job. Something had to give. She asked her employer for unpaid time off, the right to work from home, even a less senior job, all options under the Family and Medical Leave Act. "I would have swept the floors. I just wanted to keep my medical benefits," she said. After more than a year without action on her requests, she hired a lawyer who wrote to the company with demands for her rights under the act. 2 weeks later, the company told her that her job had been eliminated. The lawyer said that the company had broken the law, but that it would be grievously expensive to fight. He negotiated her severance package. "After that," she told me, "there was no way I could take another full-time job. I couldn't show up and immediately demand time off to care for my sick kid." She was back to cobbling together freelance gigs. They didn't provide insurance, and her annual income was dropping. $60,000, $50,000, $30,000. Buying insurance on the open market was costing her $1,500 each month, with medications alone costing an additional $1,500. She was digging deep into her IRA. "I had to take chunk after chunk out of it." She felt that she was running out of options. Her $2,100 monthly mortgage payment had become impossible. A broker who had become a friend advised Jolie to sell the house, and it seemed abundantly clear that I should. But it wasn't easy to begin in the middle of this nightmare. She brought in brokers who told her that the old-fashioned house, which had been deteriorating for years, would require a lot of work. Could she sell it as is? "Nobody buys fixer-uppers anymore," they said. An as-is sale might have gone nowhere. She thought of the effort of supervising a contractor and spending money she didn't have on fixes that might not help. Her brain cycled. "I obsessed and ruminated," she said, and was paralyzed. Even now she can't stop wondering how she could have saved the house. She said, "It still drives me crazy that if Obamacare had arrived even a year earlier than it did, she could have saved $100,000 in medical costs that could have gone to housing." A bankruptcy lawyer helping her deal with her medical debt suggested that foreclosure might actually help her. For the 18 months that the process would take, she could live without having to make mortgage payment or rent. In the end, the process took 4 years. Her focus, she told me, remained on her daughter. "You know, they say you're supposed to put the mask on first, on an airplane that has a sudden drop in air pressure. But there's only so much of that you can do when the kid is right in front of you. After all," she asked, "what is the best investment you can make but your kid?" Jolie had tried to keep the growing money mess from Lily. "But she's too smart," Jolie said, and Lily was growing up. One day during Lily's senior year, on the way to a doctor's appointment, Lily told her that the high school yearbook would cost more than $75. What? No! Jolie burst out. Both of them were soon in tears. Jolie found herself pouring out a rapid-fire explanation of the underlying causes of their troubles.